I was inspired by Alan's recent segment about playing games on the original hardware.
You're welcome.
Now, I think, and I realised recently, that old PC games get a bit of a raw deal in the retro gaming community. I've got my Evercade, which I spoke about recently, for playing retro games. And that has some console ports and some arcade ports and some home computer ports. But if you ever get an old PC game, it turns out that the version is usually like the PlayStation version or the a console version rather than the PC version. And I realized that I was missing some of the games or some of the versions of games that I was used to playing.
So when you talk about your early gaming experiences, it's, to my recollection, always the Amiga. So this era of your sort of early PC game playing is not apparent to me. So what were the games that you were playing on the PC?
Now, you see, yes, at home we had an Amiga, but my friend down the road, his dad had a house full of computers, and their sort of family office upstairs had a Windows 3.1 PC and an OS 2 PC.
Oh, now you're talking.
Oh, God.
And when I went round there, I was playing games for DOS and for OS 2, of which there are only about six for OS 2, but I played them all. So, yeah, my early PC gaming was DOS-based games. And that's what I'm talking about here. So, yeah, you get lots of devices for emulating console and arcade games. And home computers, you get, like, recreations of the Commodore 64 and the Amiga and the Spectrum and all of that sort of stuff. But nothing that recreates the experience I had of playing old DOS games.
Is that not because you can still very easily buy a PC that can run those games? Like, there's no... It's hard to buy a Nintendo, an old Nintendo, and all the games that you want to play, right? Whereas you could buy a PC and put the games on it and carry on playing. I wonder if it's just that PCs are so readily available secondhand, and the games as well, like on floppy disk or CD or downloaded from the internet. I don't know. Is that why? I don't know.
It's possibly that. And I mean, yeah, the point is that a lot of the games are still available to get. Not all of them, and there's a few in particular that I've realised are now sort of considered abandonware, and I'll have to see if I can track them down at some point in the future. But a lot of them are available from places like GOG and indeed from Steam. But, you know, they're sort of just part of the vast library of games you get for PC. They're not showcased as the classics that they are.
Do you have a list?
I'll get to the list later.
Okay. I'm interested in the original hardware aspect of this.
486, 586.
You see, I'm not sure of the exact specs, but the point is that it was a PC at a desk with one of those ergonomic Microsoft keyboards, which was sort of half split in two, a ball mouse with no scroll wheel because there wasn't anything for a scroll wheel to do then. You know, mouse and pointer. Because, you know, I've tried putting some of these games on the Steam Deck, and they're so based around the fact that you had a full keyboard of hotkeys to press that mapping that to a Steam Deck and getting the pointer so that it feels the same when it's used to a really low resolution screen, it's just not the same sort of experience as actually sitting there and playing it.
Right. I can understand the point you were making earlier about it being readily accessible to use console games because they mapped controllers. It's the input that's like the hard thing.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, there's websites where you can, like, with libraries of DOS games. But again, it's that sort of like 100 games in one cart problem of you just have this massive list of things and there's no like focus on these are the particular games that I'm interested in. So I wanted to create a system that showcased these sort of key DOS games that mean something to me and capture the nostalgic experience. And I'm not just talking about like obscure old games. Like, some of these are like foundational to some of the biggest franchises that are still around now, like Doom and The Elder Scrolls, Fallout, GTA, stuff like that. These all started as DOS games. So I created Dossier.
Okay, I like that. Having created Sommelier some time ago.
I know nothing about this project, but I like the name, and that's good enough.
So I wanted to create a system which would be approachable to people to, you know, rock up and play on. Like if I took this to like a retro gaming meetup or something, I didn't want it to be, it boots to a DOS prompt. And then you'd look at it and you go, ugh, and walk on to the next thing, which has like, you know, a cartridge you can stick in. So I wanted it to have some kind of GUI, but I wanted it to be era appropriate. So I started off by installing Zubuntu.
Okay.
Not just because XFCE looks old, but there is a project for Zubuntu called Chicago 95. And that skins Ubuntu with a Windows 95 aesthetic. Now, it's not like a pixel-perfect theme and recreation, but it gives you that vibe. It has a lot of the icons. It gives you the sort of start button and the right styling on all of the windows and everything. And that gives you the vibe of Windows 95.
So I saw you mention this in our Telegram channel a few weeks ago, and I was like, what is Mark up to? And this makes perfect sense. And if you want behind-the-scenes chit-chat about what we're up to, it's linuxmatters.sh/telegram.
So the other thing I did at this point was I put the screen resolution to a 4:3 aspect ratio, because none of these games are widescreen. And it turns out that having a framework laptop to prototype this on is really good, because it's not got a 16:9 screen. It's a lot, it's not quite 4:3, but it's a lot squarer. So you don't end up with massive bars chopped off the sides. Now, I might at some point see if I can get hold of an old laptop with a 4:3 screen. I did actually look at some old CRT monitors, but I don't really have room for one of those. So I backed away from that.
How did you not just get in touch with Alan Nye?
I mean, I could probably, if I stretch a little further, I could probably reach a ThinkPad nearby that has a 4:3 screen.
I'm touching a ThinkPad T43P right now.
Well, there was me thinking that you'd had a clear out of all of that, Alan.
I only kept the ones that actually were meaningful, and the T43 is one of the meaningful ones.
Well, I may be popping around your house with a USB stick at some point.
Yes.
Because this is, in fact, I deliberately installed this on a USB stick so that it would be easy to stick in another machine.
Right.
And then you boot straight into it.
Nice. So it's a live USB you've made.
Yeah. Well, I installed onto a USB stick, and then you can boot from that. I guess is that a live USB?
No, that's a persistent USB stick. Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's good. It's a good solution, that.
Yeah. So as I said before, a lot of the DOS games that are now in my collection, I've bought from Steam or GOG or somewhere like that. And the good news with that is, although they are packaged for Windows, if you run the installer they come with under Wine, what you end up with is the DOS files, and then it comes with packaged with DOSBox for Windows and a DOSBox config file to run the game. And that config file, with a few tweaks, works just as well under the Linux version of DOSBox as it does under the Windows version. So I basically just unpacked that and stuck it onto this USB stick, and then created launchers on the desktop that run DOSBox in the appropriate directory and point to that config file. And mostly it all just works from there. It pops up full screen and you're now in your DOS game.
Wow. And so you could take this USB stick plus a laptop that, you know, you want to cart around to like a retro gaming meetup. Was that the ultimate goal? So you could like show off and allow people to play these DOS games from that kind of era.
That's the idea. Yeah.
Nice.
How long does it take to boot?
Well, it depends on what you're booting it on. Do you think I should slow it down?
Well, I was going to ask about that, because I can remember back in the day when the 486s came along, there was a bunch of games that suddenly went at like a bazillion miles an hour because they hadn't factored in that the computers this fast were ever going to be a thing. And we had to create all sorts of software to slow the CPU cycles down.
Yeah, I do actually have, there is a game in my collection. It's not a DOS game, but it's a Windows 95 game called Interstate 76, which is like a driving sim. And the physics on that is tied to the frame rate So if you play it on a modern system, your driving around is usually okay, but occasionally it goes into like a cinematic cutscene where you try and do a jump. And because the physics is running too fast, you can never make the jump because you just plummet.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, these run, because these are running in DOSBox, I guess that's kind of tweaked and runs okay in all of the games that I'm playing so far. So you wanted a list of some of these games. Some of the ones I've got: SimCity 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good shout.
Star Wars Dark Forces.
Oh, yes, that is good.
Beneath a Steel Sky.
Of course.
I get no further than like the first room on that game. I can't
the first couple of rooms again and again before I cracked it. Little Big Adventure.
Oh, gosh. Wow. That's one of those games I bought, installed and never played. I think I've still got the box of that.
Yeah. I mean, like, some of these are games where I just had the demo off a cover disc, but I played the demo so much. The Elder Scrolls 2, so Skyrim being the Elder Scrolls 5. This was the precursor to the precursor to the precursor. Mm. And yes, so Fallout, the original Fallout, which I didn't actually play at the time, but I played later before I discovered any of the modern versions of the game, the modern installments of that series, and Doom, but the shareware version of Doom, because I quite like having that experience of, you know, it tells you to mail off if you want anything other than the first episode. And when you quit, it comes up with this whole tirade about how much of a wuss you are for not playing anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like if I'd installed the full version, you'd miss out on some of that era's kind of vibe.
Yeah.
When you first introduced this topic to us a little while ago, I said to you, why don't you just install DOS on a real computer, like man up, and install DOS on a real computer. And then I thought about it, and actually some of these games have requirements like audio, and a lot of, like, towards the end of the era, just don't have DOS audio support at all. And so you'd have to run it in like Windows with a Windows sound driver so that you could get the DOS game to work. And that just doesn't feel like a nice experience, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, configuring sound in DOS was always a bit of a dark art, but that's one of the nice things about DOSBox is you can just say, for this game, you need to pretend you've got this sound card. And then from there, it pretty much works. Some of them I have still had to go in and tweak the settings. And SimCity 2000 is a bit of an odd one because it can do various different sound modes. So it can just do like the beepy boopy PC speaker, or it can do the full sound blaster with the proper music.
Yeah. I mean, this was why even back in the day, every audio card that wasn't a sound blaster had a sound blaster emulation mode, because it was the surefire way you could sell your device in order for people to play games.
So the future of this project, as I've said, I'm thinking of perhaps getting an era appropriate mouse and keyboard, possibly running it on a laptop with a 4:3 screen. And also there's a couple of games that I'd really like to track down. The biggest one is the Discworld point and click adventure, which no one appears to sell that anymore, but that was one that I played quite a lot. And I'm, as I've mentioned before, I'm still a big Discworld fan, so I'd really like to get hold of that.
I will check my cargo crates. I think I have that.
Amazing.
Conference and event apps absolutely suck, and so I made one that doesn't, is what I think in my head.
Well, if you say it fast enough.
Yes. Well, plenty of people have told me recently that the thing I made was quite good, so I feel good about that. So at work, we have a hybrid conference every 6 months. So there's a bunch of people in the room, and there's talks in different rooms on various topics. And one or more of the rooms are live streamed. And so there's also a remote component where other people can watch some of the content. But the experience is different for people in the room than for remote people, of course. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to have some way that we could have a mobile experience where people could very easily see the schedule, see what was going on. And then we kind of brainstormed some other ideas as well. We had an all hands back in January in Barcelona. And there's a whole bunch of us that sat together and tried to brainstorm what a good conference app needs and what experiences we wanted the attendees of our conferences to have. And so we made a proof of concept, like mocked up data from our previous conference, so that we had like a schedule with like real people and real talks and stuff like that, so that we could demo it in a lightning talk. And then once we'd done that, someone said, well, yeah, we should make that. And so that then became my job. And that event happened as we're recording this, at the beginning of this week, a couple of days ago, and Martin was there and so was I. And I was quite pleased that it worked as well as it did. There were glitches, unsurprisingly, when you have 600 people in a room and 1,000 or more remote, things can go wrong, but it went surprisingly well.
So there were some interesting features in this app, and I'm curious where these sort of ideas emerged from. There was lots of sort of gamification going on. So where did that idea come from?
So we had a bunch of people in the room in Barcelona who have run conferences and attended conferences, and we kind of brainstormed a kind of wish list of, oh, I wish it could do that, I wish it could do that. Wouldn't it be good if we could encourage people to do certain things? And so we wanted people to be able to curate their own schedule. So rather than constantly looking at the schedule and saying, oh, what's on next? We wanted people to be able to go through the schedule and bookmark the things that they wanted to go and see. We wanted it to also be able to tell them, well, you've bookmarked two things at the same time. There's a conflict there, so you're going to have to pick one of them. But equally, it allows you to, you know, have them bookmarked, because at some point there are sometimes changes to the schedule, and that thing that you really wanted maybe moved to another room or another time slot. And if you've already bookmarked it, then you still get to go if it moves potentially. And so we wanted people to be able to like curate their own experience. But one of the most important things we've found at conferences we've been to is what's called the hallway track. Now, I thought that term was known by everyone, but it turns out it's not. And the hallway track is the part of the conference where you're not sat down in a room listening to someone talk to you. It's the random conversations you have in the hallway between one room and another. And when you're standing having a coffee or you're having a biscuit and just listening into other people's conversations, it's those conversations. And so we added some gamification, not really gamification, like some achievements and some points to try and encourage people to do the things that would make them have more conversations, like scanning each other's apps, a bit like a LinkedIn scanny thing. You get points for doing that. But also the side thing is, if you have a conversation with someone, you scan them and then you can remember them later on after the conference ends and you can get in contact. And scanning the exhibitors, rather than the exhibitors scanning you, you scan them when you have a conversation at their booth. They've all got a unique QR code on them, so that enables you to have a conversation with those exhibitors on your terms, and you scan the thing and you get points. And at the end of it, the idea was that we're just trying to make it a bit more fun and a bit more engaging with other people in the room and the exhibitors, and not just, I went to this room and I heard someone talk, and then I went to another room and heard someone talk, which is what some conferences can be like.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the whole scan a random stranger who you walk up to over tea in the morning. And not only were they unfamiliar with the concept of the hallway track, they were fully bought into the app, by the way. But this was the very first conference of any kind they had ever been to. So the whole thing was completely alien to them. So we had, you know, a whole conversation about, like, you know, why we're doing this and what the hallway track was. But also a little bit of an orientation for them as like, what am I supposed to do now? All the rest of it. It was, and I was surprised by that, you know, so they were like really green.
Nice. So one of the things that was tricky was we wanted people to be able to curate their experience, so build their little schedule, but we wanted them to be able to synchronize that schedule between devices, because the when they first get the email that the app is live and here's the app, they might be visiting it, because all it was a progressive web app. It's just a nice website, right?
I approve.
Thanks. And the idea behind that is we could send an email out and people could view it on their desktop and curate their schedule. If they sign in, it can synchronize so that when they're at the event, they can visit the same website, sign in with the same credentials on their phone, and see the schedule that they'd previously curated on their desktop. That was the idea. Now, for the people who are remote, then they have a slightly different experience, because at the event, we had talks and keynotes, but we also had workshops, and the workshops had a limited capacity. Each one of them had 60 seats, and we wanted to be able to allow people to reserve a seat, first come, first serve. And once we hit the capacity, we wanted people to be able to join a waiting list. So if someone chose to go to a different workshop, then we wanted the seat to be freed up and someone to be taken off the waiting list. Now, that was an interesting challenge to code, but it also meant that I had to be able to make sure that people who weren't there, who were virtual and just watching on the live stream, couldn't book and take up a seat when they're not even going to be there, right? And so, thankfully, we knew who was there and who was remote, because we used Luma for ticketing. And so when you buy a ticket, if you're remote, you don't pay and you just get a virtual ticket, but you still get a ticket. And if you're in the room, you've paid, or you may have used a discount code or something like that, or been comped a ticket, but your ticket type will be different. It'll be in person. And so what I did was, when you sign in, it checks the Luma API using your email address to see, is this person a virtual or an in-person? And it made the app experience different depending upon what type of ticket you had. Now, that led to some challenges and some bugs, which I was debugging on the day, because there are certain edge cases that I didn't expect, like some people having both a virtual ticket and an in-person ticket. Yeah. And my app was finding the first ticket they'd bought, which is the virtual one, because they bought that thinking, oh, that's a good event, I'll watch it remotely. And then they got budget or approval to go, and so they then bought an in-person ticket. And so there were some bugs, and I was debugging and fixing those on the day. But a lot of this stuff, it's really hard to test fully until you've, you know, got a room full of people. So, for example, an example of that is, on the first day, Simon was doing the introduction, you know, here are the fire escapes and all this kind of stuff, and here's the schedule and here's the app. And he said, I'm going to hold this slide until all of you get your phones out and scan the QR code and install the app. And I was like, oh God. And that meant there were, you know, a few hundred people all signing up to the app at the same time. No way I tested that. And so that was an interesting challenge, because I would get a notification on my phone and on my watch every time someone signed in. So I knew that it was working. And so I'm standing at the back of the room and my watch on my phone are both going burr, 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 buzzing away. It was great fun. And it mostly worked.
You're giving me flashbacks of an early Og camp. The first time we used Campfire Manager, having to go and write some SQL on the fly as people were trying to fill in the schedule, because all of the times are out by 1 hour.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes, we had a bit of that. Someone messaged me from India, I think, where it said this thing is starting in 20 minutes, and it said like 5 o'clock or something, and time zones are hard. Let's go shopping. That was a challenge. Definitely time zones did bite me at one point. But mostly it worked. One of the things I really liked about it was it had a very strong, this is what's on now, this is what's happening next. And so you could very quickly, because that's really a lot of the time what you want is, what's the thing that's happening right now? I've just had a coffee. Where shall I go now? Mm-hmm. And then after this thing finishes, you know, we're just doing our applause and I'm about to leave the room. Where am I going next? Those two things are like vital for you to be able to make your way to the next like good talk. And so that was quite good that was strong and that worked quite well. We also added the capability for people to rate and review every session. And so you could give a number of stars out of five, and there was just a plain text input field underneath it if you did leave a review, but only for in-person people. I don't think I enabled that for remote. I think I only enabled that for in-person people because I didn't want loads of random people on the internet posting horrible things. And that went quite well because it only enabled the ratings 50% of the way through the talk, because I didn't want people to just rate it one star and then leave, and all the good bit was like later on in the talk. So I wanted to give them time to see the talk before that part of the screen like lit up and let you leave a review. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. It seemed to work. We got plenty of reviews, some one stars, some five stars, and lots in between, but mostly pretty good. But I was pretty pleased with it overall. It was a bit stressful, but it mostly worked. And I think we're probably going to use it again because the next conference is in 6 months in November, 5 months in November. And the team have already said, yeah, let's use it again. And then we've got another one in June next year. And then let's use it again for that one.
And have you had any feature requests for things you need to add to the app for next time?
I had feature requests on the day. Like, like, hey, can you add a thing for this? And can you add a thing for that? Oh, also, I should mention, yes, I have had feature requests. And some of those I've already done. Mm-hmm. One of them was just as simple as like sorting things, you know, in UIs and stuff like that. Sort by clicking on columns and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty easy to do and I can deploy that. One of the things that was a bit of a challenge was I had people try to hack the points system. Now, I fully expected this. The point system was just a bit of fun, really. There was a prize at the end. There were some really nice prizes at the wrap-up on the second day. And I was a little bit surprised how much people were poking like the various APIs to try and uncover the edges that they could get through. And one guy, we were in the bar, and he pulled his laptop out and then busted out Chrome Developer Tools and started poking the API. He goes, I'm trying to figure out exactly what the maximum number of points I can get. And like an average person would get a few hundred, and someone who did all the achievements would get a couple of thousand points total. And this guy clocked up 99,999 points. So he just jumped to the top of the leaderboard. I was like, okay. But thankfully, I'd built in a whole audit thing that allowed us to reset back to what his score should have been. Not just a guess, but you know, an audit of all the things they did and reset it back down. And then a little bit later, someone popped up with 1.5 million points. I was like, okay, I need to do some work here. It was all taken in, you know, good spirits, and it was all a bit of fun. But it was an enjoyable experience. And I'm, even though it was a little bit stressful on the day, it wasn't a catastrophe. It didn't completely break down. It worked. I mean, Martin, you used it. You used basically every feature of it, and it seemed to mostly work most of the time.
Yeah, it did. It was very handy, and building my schedule was extremely useful. Now, over many years, you have had conversations with me that I can't count on my fingers and toes about making a game, a multiplayer conference game. So a multi-party game in a large conference scenario. So given that there were points in this thing and there was a gamification element, do you think that you have scratched that itch and you have now actually made your multiplayer conference game?
No.
Do you think you're going to build it in as an Easter egg in the next version?
Well, there's plenty of time. We're going to have a retrospective probably next week where we're going to feedback not just on the app, but on every part of the conference, because we're going back to the same venue in a year. And in 5 months, we're going back to the same venue we went to last year in New York, in Brooklyn. And so we're like having a little retro on everything. And the app is part of that. Yeah, if there's time, I might crowbar some Easter eggs and fun stuff in there as well. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to compromise the actual core mechanic, which is getting people to enjoy the experience of going to the event and getting the most out of the event. The thing that's been really cool after the event is our AV production team have managed to turn around all of the videos. There were like 40 talks and keynotes, and they've put them all on YouTube. And I've put a little link in every single talk. So if you go to the app, you can go to any of the talks and there's a link directly to the YouTube video. So even if you missed one, if you bookmarked it and you weren't able to see it because you're in another session, you can still watch it. And the link is right there in the app that you were already using. So yeah, it was an enjoyable experience. And come to New York or come to our conference next year in June and find out what version 2 looks like.
I have unfixed NeoVim. Last episode, I explained how over a short matter of months with 30 plugins and 1,500 lines of Lua, I had turned NeoVim into the correct editor. And since I spoke to you last episode, all bets are off. I've ditched that and I have found something better.
Wow. One episode. That's a pretty rapid cadence between one editor and the next. What have you done?
Well, I need to acknowledge the fact that this project I have been aware of for about 6 months and I've been keeping an eye on, and it wasn't ready for me to adopt previously. So I have kind of like queued these two things up together a little bit deliberately. But what I have found is a new project. It's literally been around for 5 or 6 months, and it's called Fresh or Fresh Editor. And it is everything that I want from not just a text editor in the terminal, but an IDE-based terminal. And I think the easiest way to create a visual in your mind is think VS Code or one of the JetBrains products, but in the terminal with tabs and menus and everything you would expect to find in a modern IDE, but in the terminal.
When you say it's everything I want, we should probably qualify that with everything I want today. That may change next week, next episode, but for the purposes of this episode, let's take that. What does it have that is keeping you in that text editor above other things?
Well, the very first thing is it's not Vim, it's not Vi, it's not NeoVim, it doesn't have Vim motions, it doesn't having me use the center row for navigation. It is a traditional sensible key binding with CUA key binding. So it's Control S to save, Control Z to undo, Control F to find, Shift and cursors to select things, you know, and it supports the mouse. It doesn't require any configuration. It's batteries included. It just works out of the box. So that's sort of the basics of a text editor. But then it automatically just integrates with the language servers that you've got installed. It has the Control P sort of command panel or palette that VS Code or Atom introduced, you know, to hunt through into settings quickly. It has a fuzzy finder. It has projects, ripgreps built in, it has a file explorer, and it has integrated Git status, so you can do Git blame and see when things changed. Mm-hmm. All of the things you would expect to find in a fully furnished graphical IDE, but in a text-based IDE. And it's attractive, and it all works, including things like if you bring up the explorer bar, you can grab the borders and you can resize things with the mouse. It just works like you'd expect a graphical IDE to work. So right now, it represents everything I've ever wanted from a text editor stroke IDE, but in the terminal. It's implemented in Rust, so it obviously, you know, can render at 1,000 frames a second or whatever the benchmark is today. And I know we joked about that when I was looking at Zed, but the same sort of feel is true that, yes, it is very fast and responsive. And that just translates into a nice feeling application because you always feel that it's moving at the speed of your fingertips. So whenever you bring up a menu or you type or there's a completion to happen, it's all just happening and there's never any slowdown or pauses. So that speed translates into a nice user experience.
So does this mean you're not using Zed anymore either?
I have just the two installed. I have Zed as my graphical IDE, and I am now using Fresh as my text-based IDE. And they are very equivalent experiences. So as I said when I was looking at the NeoVim stuff last episode, I connect to remote devices in order to do development work, and Fresh now gives me, alongside LazyGit, a very complete and comprehensive, you know, development environment.
You say it has everything, but surely any IDE worth its salt supports some kind of plugins and extensions. Have you explored that at all?
Yes, so it does have a plugin system, and it's quite clever, actually. So given that it's implemented in Rust, the mm-hmm. plugins are actually TypeScript plugins, but it ships, okay. I don't fully understand the technology, but it ships some sort of like embedded like JavaScript runtime VM sandbox.
Okay.
So although the plugins are TypeScript, they kind of get compiled inside this sandbox. So you don't get node modules sprayed around your system randomly. Mm-hmm. It all happens inside this sort of, you know, tidy cupboard that it keeps under lock and key. And whilst there are a load of plugins, it ships with lots. So it seems that okay. the core editor is implemented in Rust, and everything outside of the sort of essential editor is a plugin, which is shipped by default. So there's a whole bunch of stuff it can do. And when you go and look at your default installation, there's a whole raft of plugins which you can turn off and on, but they're all on by default. Most of them are language servers and things of that nature.
Yeah.
I have to say, as soon as Martin mentioned this to me, I think last Friday when I was in the office having a chat and a coffee with him, I installed it, and it's very familiar if you've ever used Turbo Pascal.
Now you're talking my language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, on that retro PC thing you were cooking up, Mark? Well, if you install Fresh Editor on that, I can't remember what, I think it's called Classic, the theme, right? And if you enable the Classic theme, it basically looks like the Borland products from the late 80s and early 90s.
It's exactly like that. Like the background of the editor is blue and everything's color, you know, yeah. highlighted correctly. And if you open a menu, you get a white panel with single line boxes around stuff. It's
sold.
Yes, I know, right? It's very nice.
So some of the other sort of like modern features that you really think of as being part of like graphical suites, I mentioned that, you know, it's got like a Git aware sort of line by line, you know, hover status, mm-hmm. but it's also got a full Git review system. So you can stage, unstage and discard individual hunks. You can see the line comments and side by side diffs and all of that stuff. I think it was you, Alan, that actually discovered it's got SSH remote editing, which I hadn't spotted, but you did when you were tinkering with it. But when we talk about like the performance, it's got a clever like Delta engine in there. So it doesn't send the whole file changes backwards and forwards. It figures out the deltas in the changes and just does these diff representations.
Okay.
It is stupid fast as well, like to update. And in some ways, I kind of forget that I'm in a terminal, and I just click to the option inside Fresh to open a terminal. I'm like, "Are you idiot? You're in one."
Right.
But you can have a little terminal box, just like you do in VS Code or Zed or any other editor, like that's attached to this session that you're currently, or this project that you're currently working on. It's really nice.
And it's got like editor tabs, which is not all that clever, but it can do split tabs. So you can have your tests in one tab and the main code in the other. So all of those things that you would do in a modern graphical editor, it supports. It's just astonishing. And some of you may be listening to this thinking, oh, text editor, not very interesting. But it is pretty. It is very well designed. I love this thing. And you can use it to replace Dollar Editor as the default editor. So if you do anything with sudo or, you know, Git, or if you're using Mutt or Melee or whatever for terminal mail, it can stand in as your text editor for those things as well. I found out the other day, quite by chance, when I accidentally shut down my machine whilst it was open, it does full recovery of unnamed scratch buffers. So I'd got some text in a text buffer. I hadn't saved it. When the system came up and I opened fresh, there was my text.
Oh, that's a relief.
All fine and, you know, uncorrupted. And, you know, if you want to ruin the experience, there's a Vim mode too. So having found this thing and fallen in love immediately, my next port of call was, of course, to theme it with the Capuchin theme so that, you know, it's of at course. Home with all of my other things. And I found a bug. And it wasn't applying all of the beautiful Capuchin colours to all of the places that I wanted the Capuchin colours. So I went hunting around and discovered that not all of the UI fields were being honoured by the theming engine. So I filed a PR, and a couple of days later, the author reviewed it, merged it, and then went on to point out that he'd found there was a whole raft of sort of config settings that weren't properly covered. So he went one better and put in a whole schema validation suite into the tests off the back of my PR. So I do now have a beautiful Capuchin themed fresh editor, and safe in the knowledge it won't regress because the author actually put a robust set of tests and things in place at the end of that.